Oh, hello there. I'm Guy Branum, and welcome to Pop Rocket, a weekly show picking over all the pop culture we love to love. With me to talk TV, film, music, and anything else entertaining, our journalist and novelist, Margaret Wappler.
Hi there, Guy.
Hello, Margaret. How you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you?
I'm doing all right myself. Are you feeling a little taxed by doing essentially two episodes in 1 week?
I am almost breathless at this point.
That's reasonable.
With excitement or exhaustion, I can't tell.
And academic and dyke about town, Karen Toxin.
Hi, Guy.
Hey, Karen.
Hi, Rocketeers.
And back again, our special guest this week is a Twitter artist,
mm-hmm.
and we said Academy Awards maven, or mm-hmm. Oscars maven.
And retired figure skater.
And retired figure skater, my co-worker on the Mindy Project, Mr. Chris Schleicher.
Hello, hello.
Hello, hello, Chris Schleicher. Coming up on this week's show, we're going to go over some of our favorite topics brought up on the Pop Rocket Facebook group. Plus, we'll each be sharing our latest jams. And before we find out what arts and entertainment news or events have caught our attention this week, if you want to hear our thoughts on the Academy Awards ceremony this past Sunday, check out our Oscars bonus discussion we put out earlier this week. All right. Now, let's do it. Chris Schleicher, what are you all about?
I am all about you brought on the Oscars maven. I'm all about the Oscar live-action shorts. Yes, every year I watch. Last year, I saw every film nominated in every category.
Wow. Whoa.
And this year, I missed two movies that were nominated for song, but I saw everything else, including the shorts. And I actually think the shorts are like the one thing that's not a chore. It's like a thing I look forward to every year. You get to see, especially in live action, five, like almost always foreign films that are excellent. And the one that won Sing is from Hungary. And it's about this girl who joins a choir that's very renowned. And the teacher tells her, just to like flap her lips and mouth along so they can win the competition. And they start to slowly realize that other kids are doing it too. And it becomes this weird allegory about like standing up to like fascism.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Wow. In a cool way. But there's another beautiful story from Spain about these parking garage attendants who one works in the day and one works in the night. And they communicate by posting a time code to look at the footage. And they're learning a dance together at different times.
That's wonderful.
And France had one about a guy, a French Algerian, applying for French citizenship, even though he's been, in his mind, French his whole life, because Algeria was part of France when he was born, and it really speaks to our situation today. And it's a great way to look at these like vivid issues in these short, digestible segments, and you walk out feeling like you saw five movies. It was playing in theaters. I think it is available streaming or somewhere online now.
Yeah, I mean, so for aspiring sophisticates out in the Midwest who are not members of the Writers Guild as you are, how did you watch them?
I went to it was playing at the New Art here. You can go to, they had a website up where the documentary shorts, the animated shorts, and the live action they were showing where they played. But I think usually after the Oscars, they release them online to watch.
There was one magical year when I believe four of the five nominees were all English language.
Mm-hmm.
And they were all vanity projects by American actors. And that's the year that Christine Lotte picked up an Academy Award for Best Original Short. Karen Toxin, what are you all about this week?
I'm all about what I usually am about, and that is Top Chef. And they aired the penultimate episode of the season, which has been set in Charleston, but this time they're in the finals round, so they're in Mexico, and this week's episode was set in the Riviera Maya. And three of my favorite ever Top Chef contestants were the three finalists this week, Brooke and Sheldon from Seattle, season 10, and Shirley Chung from season 11 in New Orleans.
But let's have a frank and honest discussion, Karen Toxin. Brooke chafed at that fucking Mayan challenge. She did not like it. She was whining about how there weren't citrus or
any kind of acids that were easily accessible.
After that man had explained to her that she was supposed to use the flowers for the citrusy notes.
It's true.
And the thing is, Brooke's fucking amazing. She came back from Last Chance Kitchen, and we all know she's the best chef on that show, but I felt like she was being pulled along by being the best chef in some. Like, did you really feel like Sheldon shit the bed enough?
I actually do think so. And this, it's hard for me to throw my Filipino brother under the bus. Also, whatever, I'm probably going to have to go to therapy for choosing like the like poised white lady over the Filipino dude from Hawaii. But I do think that, you know, his greatest mistake was not testing the fish, and everybody else tested the fish on the open flame and on the grill. And so He's also, as a Filipino chef, should know that if you want to keep the fish whole, you're going to wrap it in some banana leaves and it'll have that beautiful smoky flavor. So Sheldon, like, kind of biffed it.
I was really surprised that somebody didn't go for wrap it in a shitload of green stuff and then throw it directly on the coals where you get, like, the smokiness and the attitude from
it. You know, he could have done this thing. This Filipino dish is, like, called bungus, which is you kind of stuff the fish with aromatics or, like, with tomatoes, whatever. He had a ton of stuff to stuff the fish with, wrap it in some leaves, throw it on the coals. He could have won. And, you know, I think that probably, though, that weird crab sauce thing or whatever it was that he made may have been a little strong or too salty. So
yeah.
I don't know. I didn't taste the food, but I'm really always happy for a Top Chef all-female finale with Brooke and Shirley. You know, there aren't enough female chefs who get recognition.
Well, we have to go back to one of your grandest cultural theories, and I'm a big fan of, which was when to get to accurate representations of lesbians on television, it took Top Chef.
Yes.
And when they were scuba diving, I noticed a lot of tats on Brooke. And I was just wondering whether your spider sense had tingled at Brooke.
You know, Brooke, if anything, is a stealth bisexual, but I know she's married to a man.
Oh, she is?
So, wah, wah. But, yeah, so you know, a lot of chefs have tats, and her chefs are kind of like straight lady chef tats.
Yes.
It's not like, you know, I can usually tell when even the femmier ones, like, have, you know.
But I love the Top Chef.
The dar.
Top Chef doesn't ring a bell over somebody and insist that you know that they are gay. It just sort of lets people be people, and then once they, you know, decide to tell a story about how they're gay or their husband is trans or something like that, it's not all of their identity. It's just like part of who they are.
Yeah, absolutely. But in any case, I love those two.
If Therese and Carol had just been like, Carol Aird has a husband, there's no shot. That beautiful love story would not have happened.
I've retired from that game.
Yes, Chris. Tell the professor of Victorian literature more about reading homosexuality into a text.
God, I'm Ryan Gosling in La La Land right now.
Oh, I was totally shipping Brooke when she was up against Kristen Kish in her season when they were in the finale. I thought that would have been a cute, like, slashy.
Which one is Kristen Kish?
The sexy Asian, like, with short hair.
She's the hottest. Uh-huh. Margaret, what are you all about this week?
As the resident heterosexual right now, I'm so confused. I'm kidding. Like Chris, I've been trying to do my due diligence and wade through the many, many Oscar contenders out there. I am not as much of a completist as you or a good Oscar citizen as you are. But I did watch Captain Fantastic, and I watched that mainly for Viggo Mortensen, who was one of the nominees for Best Actor. And it's a really good movie. It's one of those movies that I feel like kind of got tucked away and didn't get seen as much as it should have. But basically, the story is Viggo plays a very serious, back-to-the-land dad who takes his family and moves them out to the wilderness of Washington and makes them kind of grow their own food and, you know, celebrate Noam Chomsky Day instead of Christmas. And he's just like the world's most humorless dad. And for anybody who's read my novel, Neon Green, shameless novel plug, there's a correlation with the dad in my book 100%. And what happens is that the mother of the family dies. This isn't a spoiler. You know it in the first 5 minutes of the movie. And basically the family structure starts to fall apart. He just can't keep this up. Without the mom. And then there's also a disagreement with the mother's parents about what should be done for her funeral. She's Buddhist. He wants her to be buried in a certain Buddhist way, and they want to go back to this, like, Christian background. It's really sharp. It's the kind of movie that could be insufferable in the wrong hands, but it's absolutely done very well, and Viggo's performance is really, like, pitch perfect. I mean, he should have absolutely been nominated for it because he's frustrating and also self-deprecating in moments, which makes him just lovable enough, and has real honor and integrity as a character, even though you want to punch him in the head half the time. So I highly recommend it. It's really great. It's directed by Matt Ross.
Well, on the subject of difficult dads, my all about this week is Fences, because like you, I was trying to catch all of the big Oscar contenders. So I went Oscars morning and watched the earlier showing of Fences that I could. And honestly, I had expected it to be work because the only, like, the August Wilson I have experienced felt like capital T theater, like Oregon Shakespeare Festival doing Joe Turner's Come and Gone, University of Minnesota doing Radio Golf. And, like, just how natural it felt, that it really felt like this very rich, beautiful language just poured out of Denzel Washington like it was coming from his pores. It just felt so human and naturalistic, and I really felt like Denzel Washington had done an amazing job of liberating it from feeling like a play without feeling like you were doing the work of liberating it from being a play. Like, just shooting in a backyard that was a location and not in any way a set, and like some really subtle and magnificent extras work of just having two women in the distance on a porch while all of the speeches are going on really made it feel so honest and direct. And like, in a world where we have so many movies about masculinity and it gets tiresome, this really, really fascinating, compelling movie that was so deeply rooted in the experience of African Americans, but also just like achingly universal, like achingly universal. And like, I lost my dad like a year ago, and I feel like I was like at exactly the right point to watch this movie about a complex and difficult relationship with a parent who doesn't know how to love you right. And like Viola Davis at the height of her powers being able to do everything that she does. But also, like, ditto for Denzel Washington. Like, it's just so easy to take that guy for granted. Mm-hmm. It's just so easy to say he does good work for us always, always. And it was lovely to have something, however good he is at everything, to have something that he put together so it could be a perfect forum for his skills. And not a flattering forum for his skills. Like, that there was beautiful artistic selflessness in taking this character who, screaming out his window, felt the equal of Lear yelling at the storm. Like, it was just so good.
Yeah, both Viggo and Denzel, I felt, show, like, how much better we are at rewarding men who are playing characters we're maybe not supposed to like or love or making questionable decisions, where we're still, a lot of the time, I mean, Isabelle Huppert is maybe the one exception this year, forced to have these, like, likability contests for women. And, yeah, in Captain Fantastic, I thought the interesting thing was I was never sure whether I was supposed to root for those kids to stay with him or not. Because you could see both sides of the argument pretty fairly having their points. And Denzel being someone that, like, is so charismatic in that movie but can't help himself from making these bad decisions and can't express love in the right ways.
Well, and also that the play and the film itself, I never knew how much Viola Davis at the end was supposed to be right about the extent to which, like, Corey had just turned into Troy. Like, I didn't know, like, it felt like it had reached the point where art just sort of, like, shatters into reality, and it's just, you know, you're not being steered as much anymore.
I'd also like to take a second to respond to the haters who are just like, it's just a filmed play. Where I'm like, I'm sorry, do you hate Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
Right. Yeah, there's a lot of filmed like, plays.
Yeah. It's, film play sounds great to me.
Yeah, it's like the bedrock of the film industry before 1985.
All right, you guys have been listening to Pop Rocket. We'll be right back to talk about our favorite Pop Rocket Facebook group post after this.
The Dead Pilot Society podcast brings you hilarious comedy pilots that were never made, featuring actors like Aubrey Plaza, Andy Richter, Paul F. Tompkins, John Hodgman, Adam Scott, Molly Shannon, Busy Phillips, Tom Lennon, Anna Camp, Laurie Metcalf, Felicia Day, Michael Ian Black, Adam Savage, Paul Scheer, Ben Schwartz, Skylar Astin, Mae Whitman, Josh Molina, Ben Feldman, Nicole Byer, Jason Ritter, Sarah Chalk, Steve Agee, Jane Levy, Allison Tolman, Danielle Nicolette, Casey Wilson, Anna Ortiz, Lorraine Newman, June Diane Raphael, Kieran Shipka, Ed Week, Zach Knight, and Carrie Kenny Silver, John Ross Bowie, Jamie Denbo, Janet Varney, Alexander Forsyth, Summer, Ellen Ross, Matt Worley, and many more. Listen at MaximumFun.org, iTunes, or wherever you download podcasts.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio are
Margaret Wappler,
Karen Tongson,
Chris Schleicher.
And before we get into the formal questions, I was reading something that somebody posted on the Facebook group about the Moana dance number from the Oscars last night, and I was just wondering if you had any visceral reactions to that poor girl getting hit in the head.
I thought there was something so symbolic about a brown person being hit by a flag in the head, like in this era of America right now. Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
I was all over it because, number one, Pacific Islander magic.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, the flags from Color Guard, and I was in the marching band in high school. And, you know, and plus Ali'i Carvalho is a really beautiful singer and performer, and I hope that we figure out what to do with her
right
after this. So, yeah, I think that I hope that a GIF or JIF or however the frack you pronounce that word will circulate and leave, like keep her in people's minds for future projects.
So I have a theory about that moment, and it's that Olivier Award nominee Nicole Scherzinger deeply wanted to sing that song. Like,
oh.
She's like the most famous like singer from the movie, probably wanted it. And watching this girl perform and like be like sound just as good and be prettier and younger, that she was like Snow White and the Huntsman doing magic. And all she could do was budge a flag into her head.
Mm, okay. It was a hex.
So do you feel like the 2 to 3 dance numbers from songs that are worth dance numbers are worth it when we still have to sit through Sting or some sort of like boring, turgid song from a documentary or something like that?
I like that. It's weird the things we decide to cut and the things we don't. Like, we didn't get the Anoni or the Simple Song performance last year, which were mm-hmm. both like beautiful songs because they weren't like famous enough, and that we have to sit through Sting is sort of a disappointment. Or the year that we didn't sing El Otro Lado del Rio and it won.
Yeah.
Yeah, I really think there can be some cuts.
Well, I really hated the fact that we wasted the Justin Timberlake song on the opening number. I mean, yeah, it gave us an opening number and we didn't have to deal with Jimmy Kimmel, like, singing or dancing. But it also meant that halfway through, when I would have liked a nice song, like, there was nothing there except for two relatively boring La La Land songs. Like, I, for some reason, thought one of the fun La La Land songs was nominated. And, like, yeah, car dancing song or ladies getting ready song, that would have, like, kept things moving. But, like, the ones that were there were terrible.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Justin Timberlake did kick off the show with the right tenor. And I imagine that the Sting song really only was included because it was Sting. And we know Sting's face. And so it's, like, fine.
Even though
he's holding
like
his guitar possibly
face.
High, which I know is a classically trained thing, it still looked weird. But, yeah, that's all I got to say about
that. I really hated the opening number.
Really?
Actually, I found it just so, like... Like
it was very Grammy
Orlando Disney like and
that's
as
we got his training.
I know, as we, you know, as we've said on the show before, that is like the thirstiest song ever, and it felt even thirstier opening the Academy Awards and seeing Justin try to like coax people into dancing, try, you know, and stimulate Nicole Kidman's awkward clapping, the whole deal.
I mean, that just that Isabelle Huppert had to sit through the song from Troll.
Exactly.
The whole time she just looked like, why am I here again?
The thing I liked...
Humiliating.
The thing I liked most about it is that it started in the mall parts. And I just wish there was more of a sense of, this is a mall that they're doing this in anytime we're watching the Academy Awards. Okay. Crystal Davis Pascal asked, could we be so lucky in response to the news that Remy Ma was dropping a Nicki Minaj diss track? Did anyone listen to the diss track?
No, sir. No.
It's amazing. So apparently the story is that the two of them, like, had beef, and then Remy went off to jail for 6 years while Nicki was having her glorious rise to fame, and now Remy is back to call shit down.
Empire.
And this, this diss track, I'm not somebody who likes hip hop, but I love a good Real Housewives franchise. And this diss track has talk shit about her butt implants, like goes through like her business structure, like the issue of her
business
having
structure?
Too many.
It's like an MBA diss.
It's wonderful. She talks about how she has too many reps, which means she has too many fingers going through her money before she gets it. So you make like 35 cents for every dollar I make. It is magnificent. I have no idea who Remy Ma is, but I now just want to know more about her. Like, the shit talking is so, like, it is just nothing but pure tea gossip. And, like, I would recommend that everybody take a listen.
The business structure critique aspect of it sounds a lot like a Real Housewives song.
No,
like it does, you know?
So frequently we get too into women tearing down women as a thing. But in the world of hip-hop, where, like, a diss track, like, is a part of the genre, it, like, weirdly feels like equality.
No, it's so wonderful, and it is threats of murder. It's like I have my guns. I'll make you go down, or I'll make your carpet red. Like, it's so beautifully, like, high celebrity fashiony, but also visceral. Okay, let's listen to a little bit of it.
The line about bitches being your sons. How you take my 09 jail tweet and run? Talking about bringing knives to a fight with guns when the only shot you ever took was in your buns. And I saw Meek at All Star. He told me your ass dropped. He couldn't fuck you for 3 months because your ass dropped. Now I don't think I understand how bad her ass got. The implants that she had put in her ass pop. I was like, damn, 90 days and you couldn't have box. Did she at least compensate? Start giving you mad top. Her name Minaj, right? She ain't throw you some bad thoughts. He said, nah, that's when I knew you was really a trash bop. You was screaming free Remy when I was upstate doom. But now that they free Remy, you don't sing the same tune.
I was just going to say, what I should have said is that Nikki's going to come back hard to this.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I'm very excited for it. But also, like, the run about how you didn't have sex because your butt implants exploded. Just.
It's a hazard of butt implants.
I mean, that's good television right there. All right. Victoria De Leon says, I just caught up with last night's episode of This Is Us, and I got to say I'm wrecked. I think it's a great standalone piece, even if you don't watch the show. Are there any other TV episodes, etc., that make you cry uncontrollably? Well, my official favorite episode of television ever is a third season episode of The Mary Tyler Moore Show. Chris Schleicher, take over.
Road of the Beautiful?
Road of the Beautiful. Chris is a deep Valerie Harper fan. Mm-hmm. Road of the Beautiful is an episode where after three seasons of being with Mary Tyler Moore and Rhoda, like, and we're rewarding a woman for losing weight and all of that. Fuck you. It was 1973. We were still learning how. Those bitches were teaching us how feminism works.
We're real. Like, very skinny Valerie Harper is, like, the fat one.
Yes. But it is just... It is just the right amount of reward that feels earned for this person learning to believe in herself and watching Mary Tyler Moore or Mary Richards have to hold Rhoda's hand through believing in herself is the kind of thing that I watch just to remember why I love TV.
I mean, for me, like, there's, like, moments that, like, signal crying, like, the finale of 6 Feet Under that makes everyone, like, weep until, like, they're a puddle.
Yeah.
But, like, one moment that, like, came to me when I first heard this question was, like, it came on me unexpectedly, and it's a little embarrassing, was on Glee when Darren Criss sang Teenage Dream to Kris Kofor.
Oh, God, yeah.
It was a sort of thing, like, I didn't realize I hadn't been represented in this way just to see a teenager expressing love for, I mean, it's not quite, they barely know each other yet, but, like, sort of like a homosexual, like, attraction and affection on TV. I started crying out of nowhere. And it's these ways that you don't know that you haven't seen this thing yet until it arrives.
I started crying, actually. I watched the Glee pilot while I was at the gym on some sort of weird machine. And, of course, when, you know, the little Glee club that could start singing Don't Stop Believin' at the end, I just lost my shit, like, on the, like, elliptical or whatever.
One time in Mexico, I was doing curls, and Up in Spanish was playing, and I started just barely paying attention to it, and then I was weeping uncontrollably while doing curls.
That sounds like a tough combination.
It was the
like,
silliest.
Curls are shitty enough without putting tears in there.
Margaret, what about you?
I don't know if I'm so much of a sentimental crier. In fact, I'm really sort of like my hackles are raised when I feel like shows are trying to make me cry out of those kinds of moments. But I think this is fresh in my mind because I recently rewatched this episode kind of out of nowhere. But the episode of The Sopranos where Lorraine Bracco's character she's raped in a parking lot and she has a session with Tony Soprano afterwards. And she bursts into tears in the middle of the session. And it's such a vulnerable moment because she's trying to be tough and professional. But she just can't keep up the mask, and he sees it. And there's also this moment where you know she's weighing, like, do I tell him what happened so that he can go after the guy?
Her rich temptation in that moment, again, it's one of those things where seasons into a show, like this character who has been so well established, you test the boundaries of them. It's a great episode.
Yeah, and it's just something about her bursting into tears like that. It reminds me of the fact that, like, I think every woman who's ever cried at a job sort of has this automatic shame response to that, because it's such a liability for women in particular to cry at a job. It's like, oh, you're weak, you're a woman, you're crying. And so I think that all, it just calls all of that up. And the fact that she, you know, immediately sort of like smooths herself down, but is still visibly, you know, haunted and saddened. It's just so powerful. It's just, I mean, she's that episode in particular is like worth all the money for her.
I want to bring up another moment.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to take seconds, but the Dreamgirls medley from the Academy Awards, whatever year that was.
81 or 2 or something?
No.
The film. Yeah.
The film.
Yeah.
Just the fact that, like, everyone shows up and it's Jennifer Hudson's nice night, and Beyonce understands that the only way that she can try to wrestle this evening towards herself is to give everything in her performance. And she does, in a way that she never has in a film, and just explodes on stage, is one of those things that, like, it's not sentimental crying. It is like being overwhelmed by the beauty and somebody just giving all of it. I recommend that strongly. And everybody here is familiar with Crybabies, the podcast, right?
No.
I've heard of it, but...
Okay. So Sarah Thayer, who is a very funny actress and writer, and Susan Orlean, who wrote The Orchid Thief and was a Meryl Streep in adaptation, or Meryl Streep played her in adaptation, they have a podcast called Crybabies that is entirely people talking about their, like, art crying triggers, or I guess all of their crying triggers. But it's a very good podcast. Oh. And
I need to watch it. I mean, I'm working on a book about TV shows that make you cry involuntarily.
Oh, really?
Well, a particular genre called norm porn. So shows like Parenthood or like 30-something. Or This Is Us, in fact, which was the sort of prompt for this question.
Karen, do you remember The Slap?
Oh, yeah. And The Slap is something that I brought up in this thing about norm porn.
I feel like The Slap was how I got to know you and what you loved and believed
in. We had that joke, I think, once that got cut on Mindy Project, where Tamara had seen a promo for Parenthood. She's like, it told me it was going to make me cry, and it did.
Also, one of my worst moments at the Mindy Project was, like, in my first season there, we were watching, like, the mid-season finale, and they played the same MIA song that they had played in the pilot of the Mindy Project. And so I, in our writer's room, was just messy crying, and Mindy was like, we should change this song. And I was like, never! She's good at her job! okay. Jessica Lauren says, so while I usually agree with the masses that the novel is always better than the film, I have two favorites that I insist the film is far superior. Practical Magic and the Jane Austen Book Club. Do any of you have any films that you prefer to their original novels? First of all, there's a fucking novel of Practical Magic?
I know, that was a shock to
that
me.
That was a shocker.
I kind of want to read it.
It isn't a film, but I will start us off by saying, after I saw Wicked, I was like, oh, I will read the novel of this. It must be good. I was very wrong about that. And look, the book of Wicked is pretty weak, but, like, it's still a better story than whatever shit show that novel is. It's real terrible.
I mean, first thing that comes to mind for me is, like, many of the Harry Potter movies cut out a lot of, like, the stuff that's, like, I feel like J.K. Rowling's like, I have to do a Quidditch tournament this year. Like, they built this into the formula, and, like, they cut that stuff out. But my number one answer for this is They Shoot Horses, Don't They? Which is one of my favorite movies of all time. It's from 1969 with Jane Fonda, and it's about a, like, dance marathon type contest, and all these desperate people are entering to try and get money. And it was sort of this, like, crime novella that's, like, a little pulpy, but it becomes this, like, horrifying, like, comment on, like, entertainment, like, and how it pushes people through the mill. and like drives people to the brink. And it's like very hard to find on DVD. I have like a copy that I treasure. And I just love that movie.
I don't know if I prefer, well, I would say that I treasure The Prince of Tides as a film a little more than I treasure the novel The Prince of Tides by Pat Conroy.
You've read the entirety of a Pat Conroy novel?
Oh, I've read more than one Pat Conroy novel. And the thing is, I really, you know...
Did you read it in a hotel where the book was there for free?
No, I think I was like 16 or something, and I really wanted to get deeper into The Prince of Tides because I'd seen the film and I was like really into
that's so cute.
I was like, I'm going to read a bunch of Pat Conroy novels, including like The Great Santini or whatever the fuck. But there are a lot of purple prosy excursions.
Oh, those fucking sentences, you know, are the worst.
And I mean, I think I tried to write in my journal for a while like Pat Conroy, which is very embarrassing. But I like the concision of, and the narcissism of the Lowenstein narrative, like coming to the fore in the film adaptation versus, you know, all the kind of sad Wingo family stuff.
We get so much Jason Gould in that movie.
Exactly. In a football outfit.
Can I tell you a horrible purple prose story, Karen?
Sure.
You're going to hate every part of this. I loved Henry James so much until I read a Camille Paglia essay about Henry James that was basically like just pointed out that you need like a machete in a week to get through one of those sentences. And then every time I tried to read him after that, I was just too aware of how convoluted and viney those sentences
were. I can't believe Camille Paglia put you off Henry James.
I know. I was a much younger man. I need to go back.
That is such a 90s college story.
Yes.
Experience.
Totally.
I have two answers. One being The Devil Wears Prada, which, I mean, the book is, you know, just kind of a tell-all from Lauren Weisberger. And it's, you know, it's just like a pretty basic story. And it really gets elevated on film by Meryl Streep's performance. I mean, it's just like that. That is just not living on the page. The other one I would say is There Will Be Blood, which is the, you know, P.T. Anderson movie. And it's based on this Upton Sinclair book. And that one's called Oil, and granted, the relationship between those two is somewhat tenuous because he only used like parts of the book. But the book is like a very minor work, and it's not, you know, very riveting at all, whereas the movie is like completely riveting.
To your Devil Wears Prada point, I feel like there is a lot. The thing is we have a higher bar for screenplays than we do for pulpy YA and quote-unquote women's novels getting published. And I feel like there are a lot of those things that are really, really crap, especially the YA novels, or crappy YA novels, that are then turned into serviceable films because a lot of people weigh in on a film as it goes through.
Yeah, because they know, too, that it can become this huge franchise, so, like, so much energy just gets pushed into that.
What would you say, across all genres, is, like, the adaptation that surprised you most? Do you have anything where you were like, wow, that's magical, that worked? Or alternatively, what work would you most like to see on ice?
An adaptation that I really liked was the recent Joe Wright Anna Karenina, because I spent a whole year getting through that book.
Right.
And honestly, like 30% of it is Anna's love story, and a lot of it's like going to Siberia to talk about like farm councils.
Yeah.
So they just like took a like axe to that story and like set it inside a theater, and you're like going around different rooms of the theater rather than doing this gigantic Dr. Zhivago production of it. It's very small and an interesting way of like people watching each other, and it's a cool take for like something that would cost like so many million dollars to do in a big way. Was like a rethinking of it that I thought was cool.
Yes, Karen, let me just say, that period of time when we didn't know precisely what should or shouldn't go in a novel is horrible, and I blame you for it personally.
Oh, every George Eliot novel,
yes.
You mean?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Adaptation I love that should not have worked. I'm going to like bring it up. I've brought it up before, but the Xanadu Broadway musical was so fucking good and managed to take everything that felt slightly wrong about that movie and lean into it and just say, this is a beautiful story. And, you know, like my takeaway from La La Land is this is less fun Xanadu. Like, it's the same kind of we are in L.A. destined to be dreamers, but didn't realize it should be corny. And the work of absolutely everyone in that, and I don't know if anyone here is familiar with Xanadu.
But I'm familiar with Xanadu.
Yeah.
It's understanding that the perfect way to lean into it was to do light Clash of the Titans homage. is so beautiful. While I was watching it, when I realized that the actresses who were playing the muses all double as the goddesses, and when they were playing the goddesses, were doing bad impressions of Claire Bloom, Ursula Andress, and Maggie Smith playing the goddesses. And I was like, oh, yes, that's why she's doing a Swedish accent. This is the best. This is the best musical of all time. It shouldn't work, but it does.
Gosh, I mean, I have such a hard time with this. Like, you'll have to skip me because my very boring answer was how much I like the BBC adaptation of George Eliot's Middlemarch.
Oh, that's perfectly fair.
And, you know, because it managed to get all of the kind of boring, realist, wonky stuff that, like, plods the story along
into
what ends up being a kind of sweeping continental romance in the end, right? So, and I like not sacrificing the weird, like, trading of the goat or what have you, or the sale of the sheep in this particular part of land. And so, I don't know. That is why I suppose I became a Victorianist, even though I no longer do that work so much anymore.
I mean, if the BBC knows how to adapt,
yeah,
you know what I mean?
Seriously.
Like, that's their whole bread and butter right there. I mean, to me, one of the interesting ones is adaptation. That's why I was pointing at you with excitement, because I thought you were about to mention that one. I mean, speaking of The Orchid Thief, like, that is a case of, you know, Spike Jonze taking this text from Susan Orlean and basically twisting it into something completely different than what was on the page. I mean, using it ostensibly, but shooting off from it into something so much more. And I think finding a way to use it to talk about film and what we expect out of an adaptation. And it's really brilliant.
That's a great point, Margaret.
Oh, thank you.
All right. Zachary Davis says, what movie or scene traumatized you as a child? For me, it was the fizzy lifting drink scene in Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. Not only was I worried about the suspense of some major gore while watching, I was also vehemently opposed to Charlie and Grandpa Joe breaking rules like that.
I can much relate to the being a child afraid of breaking rules, because in Beauty and the Beast, when, like, she's like, I'll just go into the West Wing, even though he told me I can't. And, like, Cogsworth is like, you can't. It's against the rules. It's like, listen to the clock.
I had the traumatic experience of seeing the film Quest for Fire with my parents and my great-grandmother in a theater in Manila when I was about, like, 8 years old. I don't know if any of you recall Quest for Fire.
I do.
But there's, like, some really raunchy cave sex that happens in that.
Oh,
and
yes.
So it was a primal scene in more ways than one. And so far as there, I'm sitting with my very aged, very Catholic, Pope-worshipping Filipina great-grandmother and my parents. And they're, like, cave people going at it like cray. And it was a formative moment.
What else were they supposed to do?
Right? Because they were just trying to figure out all the positions.
Yeah.
That was what was happening, like, as they're also trying to figure out fire.
Yes, exactly. It gets boring looking for fire sometimes.
Exactly.
One of my favorite family stories is that one of my brothers went to go see Black Swan with my mom. And, I mean, just thinking about the two of them sitting next to each other during the, like, Mila Kunis lesbian scenes is just so delightful. But, I you know, basically, I just go back I think I've talked about this before on the podcast, going back to E.T., where the fact that E.T. ate Reese's Pieces really freaked me out as a 4 or 5 year old, because it was my favorite candy.
Oh, no.
And I remember asking my dad, like, I don't think I can eat these anymore. I'm going to turn into an alien. And so he had to, like, convince me. We had to eat them, like, together slowly and sort of wait to see. You're not going to transform.
Oh, that's so sweet.
Yeah. Crazed.
My real moment is the poltergeist getting sucked into the TV.
Oh.
Like, I was, like, not able to recover from for, like,
yes,
many years. The static.
That is, like, my second one.
The static on the, like, would run away from. But because I'm trying to backdate my age, I was a child when Mulholland Drive came out. And the moment.
That would be scarring as a child.
The moment behind the dumpster when, like, the creature pops out, like, still gives me nightmares.
Okay. So, in a real way, When I saw the Twilight Zone movie, there's a scene in it where it's the one sort of like portion of it where the little boy has omnipotent powers and is being terrible to everyone in his family. Does anyone else remember this?
Wait, which movie?
This is the Twilight Zone movie from like 1981 or 1982. Mm-hmm. I was not scarred by the portion where several Vietnamese children got killed.
like as a kid, you just accept that.
Yeah. Oh, this happens in the 80s in movies.
So basically, it's based on a classic Twilight Zone where Billy Mumy is omnipotent and terrible. He's the monster of the town, but he's just an omnipotent six-year-old. And in it, like, there are lots of horrifying things, but there's one scene where you see his sister, the top of her face, and then you just pull out, and she has no mouth. And it was just so upsetting to me that it's one of those things, in the way that I am still scared of the Dark Crystal. Like, if that is ever on the television and I see it happening, I have to, like, go into another room and forget that it's going on because it scarred me very deeply. Do either of you, I'm less concerned about you, have either of you seen The Twilight Zone where Billy Mumy is the omnipotent child monster?
No.
I don't think so.
It is the most, like, watch it because who our president is. like,
oh, God.
It is, it's like really, really terrifying and magical. And
does he eat a steak with ketchup?
Yeah. Well done, steak with ketchup.
In the movie version, he makes them put peanut butter on hamburgers and you're disgusted by it.
Yeah, that's whack.
All right, you are listening to Pop Rocket. We will be right back with our jams after this.
My name is Patrick.
My name is Ariel.
My name is Joe Coughlin. The first time I went to Max FunCon, I didn't know anyone. I was really nervous about that.
Everyone said not to worry about going alone, that I'd make friends right away, that I'd have an amazing time. It turns out, everyone was right.
I instantly had 200 new friends.
I've made lifelong friends at Max FunCon that I'm going to keep in touch with for the rest of my life.
If you aren't sure if you belong at Max FunCon, you belong.
Don't be like me. Don't waste 2 years being too nervous. Just go already.
Join Ariel, Patrick, and Joe at Max FunCon. Tickets for Max FunCon and Max FunCon East are on sale now at maxfuncon.com.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Brandon. With me in the studio are
Karen Tongson,
Margaret Wappler,
Chris Schleicher.
Now, every week on Pop Rocket, we ask that age-old question, what's your current jam? Karen Tongson, you got a jam?
Yes, my jam is actually still a kind of Oscar hangover jam, and it is from that beautiful moment in Moonlight, the scene in the diner in the final third of the film. And it's a song that I believe comes on the jukebox, but I can't remember if it's just sort of, but it's diegetically in the scene, and it is Barbara Lewis's Hello Stranger from 1963.
I'm so happy you picked this.
Hello, stranger. It seems so good to see you back again.
Oliver Wang is smiling down at you right now.
Well, you know, I mean, this song is, you know, whatever. What it registers is this sort of sense of longing and fulfillment, like longing at the precipice of fulfillment. That moment when, you know, you say hello, that, you know, when you see somebody who you haven't seen in a long time. And she got the line, "Hello, stranger, how you doing?" from actually folks who would be around at her shows, who'd always, you know, like when she was on tour with her dad, people would always come up to him and say, "Hey, stranger, how's it going? How's, you know?" And she built this whole kind of romantic narrative around that. And the song was a great hit in 1963. It went up to number 3 on the Billboard pop charts, number 1 on the R&B charts. Anyway, it's a gorgeous song. The organ riff in it is infamous by John Young, and the arrangement was made by Riley Hampton, who worked a lot with Etta James, and you can hear a lot of those textures in that song.
Well, an interesting point with Moonlight is that gay men are so known for processing our emotions through women's art. And there are such small presences of positive women in Chiron's life. Mm-hmm. And like in that final third, when he has turned himself into the ultimate masculine being, it is so lovely to have that woman's voice come in there.
And that sort of sweet, melty, like mid-century, like Detroit balladeer-y way.
Yeah. Margaret, you got a jam?
I sure do. In my continued Oscar research, I finally saw Jackie, and I really loved it. And part of what I loved about it is that Natalie Portman really splits her performance between two Jackie personas, one being this kind of public, ultra-feminine, soft-spoken kind of woman that you often saw, you know, through the White House tour and that kind of thing. And then this other flintier, more, you know, even slightly abrasive woman that really kind of like lived in the shadows a bit and processed her anger and resentment there. And something else I really liked about the movie is that it's really history according to a person who was there, but who often doesn't get to tell her story. So many of the times, like, I mean, we think about all the presidents and they all had wives and we barely know any of their histories. And one of the things that was outstanding to me about Jackie was the score. And the score is from Micah Levi, who is part of a band, or really it's her band, Mikachu and the Shapes. And I didn't even put that together until later. But at any rate, this is one of the songs from the movie called just Intro. It just basically sets the tone for the movie. Just like so haunting and beautiful, and it matches the tone of the movie so perfectly. I mean, I don't know, rarely do you see like a match like this. And Mikachu and the Shapes, if you haven't checked that out, you should. She has a 2009 album called Jewelry that's really especially excellent.
One of the things that was striking to me about Jackie was that I expected we would see public Jackie and then you would see something probably stronger and more noble behind closed doors, and it wasn't necessarily noble. Like, it really was this person's falling apart and she's trying to manage, but she, like, it gave us a real sense of like that chaos that you hear there.
Yeah. I mean, but you know, also this was in the week after the movie takes place, and basically the week after her husband was shot.
Yeah.
So it does feel like it's fair for her to just be steeped.
Absolutely.
In chaos. But worry about the sake.
And it feels so haunting, and there's this sense of like inescapable history and like being caught in the clutches of it. And the soundtrack really, I feel like, contributes to this sense of like doom closing in.
It feels like we're probably going all Oscars on our jams.
Mm-hmm.
Chris Schleicher, what's your jam?
So my jam is Numakita Pa from the film The Umbrellas of Cherbourg, a French film in 1964, a musical with Catherine Deneuve, entirely sung, and it is one of the inspirations for La La Land. And full disclosure, I really like La La Land.
apologist.
I feel like that you...
In I the didn't Oscars, hate it.
Yeah, we act like it's a zero-sum game where like liking Moonlight means hating La La Land and the other way around, and they're both excellent films to me. Mm-hmm. But I'm biased because one of my friends from college, and the first person I ever came out to, is Justin Hurwitz, who wrote the
score
to La La Land.
I didn't know
and
that.
And we go see Umbrellas of Cherbourg when it's playing in theaters.
Oh, that's lovely.
So it's just the most beautiful, like sweeping, entirely sung movie, and it also has an ending of what could have been if we'd made a different choice. And this is the big love song in the middle.
Mais je ne pourrai jamais vivre sans toi. Je ne pourrai pas, ne parle pas, j'en mourrai. Je te cacherai et je te garderai. Mais mon amour ne me
At this point in the movie, her lover, she's very young, is about to go off and serve his military service in Algeria, and she just has to wait for him for 2 years and come back, and it sort of doesn't happen in the way in La La Land. Spoiler, they sort of doesn't work out for them at the end. They make choices, and their lives end up in very different places. And this theme gets repeated again at the end when they see each other for the first time in years after being separated and their lives going in different directions. And it becomes this like very sad but hopeful what might have been song. And so when I see La La Land, I see those echoes of it in it. Yeah.
My jam is also me processing La La Land, not in as sunny of terms. Like, my jam is someone in the crowd from La La Land. It was the song that came the closest to giving me what I want from a musical. Let's listen to it. All right, you're in a musical right there. My issue was that it didn't have enough specificity and perspective, that it was this, like, glowing primary colors, girls getting ready number, but it didn't have any sense of wry awareness of the fact that it was going to a Hollywood Hills party, and they were essentially saying, I hope I'm attractive enough that somebody helps my career. Like, and I was like, and I, my mind went to those great getting ready songs, like Put On Your Sunday Clothes or, from Sweet Charity, There's Gotta Be Something Better Than This, which really is hooked into the idea of, like, you know, how can I leverage my sexuality? Can we hear some of that?
There's gotta be something better than this. There's gotta be something better to do. And when I find me something better to do, I'm gonna get up, I'm gonna get out, I'm gonna get up, get out and do it.
There's gotta be something. And tell me, was La La Land just a different kind of musical?
Yeah. My theory is yes here, because that song was, to me, I really loved it because it was like fizzy and French, and it reminds me of Michel Legrand. Also did Les Demoiselles de Rochefort, The Young Girls of Rochefort.
Yeah.
And it feels like a song straight out of that.
Uh-huh.
And Damien is French-American, as the French ambassador I always follow is tweeting about.
Yes.
And it feels like the stylistic influences of it are the French musicals and not the American ones.
Really?
Yes.
Karen, do you have hard thoughts on La La Land?
I mean, like I said, I didn't hate it. In fact, when I saw it with a group of friends, I was the person defending it at the end of the screening. So, and I went with a lot of filmy people, film scholars, cinematographers, whoever, and they were having a conversation, in fact, about the Umbrellas of Cherbourg. And I found all the kind of citationality of it to be very sweet. And I anticipated the race critique, but I also sort of saw, like, what kind of saccharine framing, you know, kind of a fantasy world was being forged in the film. So I was not as harsh on it as many other folks in my milieu are. But you know, yeah, I felt that nothing captivated me musically in a way that really stuck, except for that repetitive refrain in City of Stars, you know.
The thing is, like, going into the opening number, I was like, Guy Branum, this movie is going to mean way more to little queer children over time than Moonlight ever will. Like, they will fall in love with this. This will make them dream of being that lady. And that feeling lasted for two numbers.
Yeah.
And then we talked about jazz for an hour, and I was less committed to it.
For me, though, the big moment that I was so thrilled to see the movie was the Dream Ballet, which you rarely get in a musical anymore.
Yes.
And that fully, I was like hovering like 5 inches above my seat, because like that is what I like live for in a musical. And it brings you back through the moments of the film. And Damien, I think, is very good at beginnings and endings. There are some maybe like slow moments in the middle of that movie, but
the last
they send you out on a high note.
Fucking
and it,
great.
And it just like ends right there. Yeah. I thought was really good.
Margaret, thoughts on La La Land?
I haven't seen it yet because I have a strict no jazz-splaining policy in my life, but I'm working up to it. I'm working up to it.
That's fair, Margaret. No one's going to begrudge you that. You have been listening to Pop Rocket, hosted by me, Guy Branum, with Margaret Wappler, Karen Toxin, and our very special guest, Mr. Chris Schleicher. Chris, tell everyone again where they can learn more about you.
You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at cschleichsrun or just search Chris Schleicher. And you can find my episodes of The Mindy Project on Hulu.
The more you watch them on Hulu, the more he makes in residuals. Our theme music is Party Booby Trap by Ozzy Mizo. Thanks to him for letting us use it. Again, thanks to Veronica's BFF, Wilder15, and Margaret for President for the 5-star reviews on iTunes. Because we have 2 episodes, you do get mentioned twice. Also, Margaret, what are your platform planks?
Oh, you know, tearing down the wall, taking down all those bands.
Steaks medium rare.
Jazz-splaining illegal.
Exactly.
If you haven't already, please review us. Get in touch with us on Twitter. We're at Pop Rocket. Join our Facebook group and join in the discussion. It's always a good time. We are a production of MaximumFun.org, and our producers are Kara Hart and the resourceful Christian Duenas.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.